Dear colleagues and friends, firstly, I would like to thank Sorbonne University and its doctoral school, Concept et Langage, as well as the Senior RS Lab Laboratory, the GEMAS, for the financial assistance they provided in the organization of this conference. And especially Michel Dubois, who will share this morning's session, for his constant support during the past 3 years it took to develop the project of publishing a handbook on methodological individualism. So as not to repeat myself, I will say MI. This book, which has now been completed, has 2 volumes and features almost 60 chapters with contribution from all over the world. I would like to extend my gratitude to everyone for your work towards this major project. The objective is to disseminate true, robust, and updated knowledge about MI, an approach that is both central to social sciences and paradoxically the most misunderstood. The excellence of the contribution should not be underestimated. They will, without a doubt, help to, as I would like to put it, rehabilitate MI as a fundamental approach within social sciences. Indeed, this contribution demonstrates that MI should not be conflated with political or moral individualism. At a time when the term was not yet commonly used, the famous Austrian economist Karl Menger, one of the founding figures, wrote in essence that political individualism has as little in common with the individualistic method in economics as a gunpowder conspiracy, as with theoretical chemistry. L'individualisme politique a autant à voir avec la méthodologie individualiste qu'une conspiration sur la poudre avec la chimie théorique. Moreover, Menger also dismissed the accusation of reductionism, or what was then commonly referred to as atomism, a term he always used with an exclamation point. In particular, micro-reductionism assumes that theories that deal with a given whole can be replaced by theories that deal with its part, the part being conceived with characteristics independent from their belonging to the whole. Menger explained, in essence, as Max Weber would also later underscore, that an atom in physics is not an isolated element. Rather, it is an element of a theoretical system that defines what it is, how it functions, and how it interacts with other elements. Advocating for a better understanding of MI within our scientific community, in my view, would enable the social sciences to reassess their foundation. It could also put an end to future debates attacking straw men, paving the way for meaningful discussion on further progress. The case of economics is somewhat distinct, yet here too, a deeper interpretation of MI is more likely to address the logical problems Olivier Favreau will discuss tomorrow. Let me say that it is a great pleasure to welcome you here to this venerable amphitheater within an even more venerable university. The historical development of this institution, linked with that of the University of Paris, is brilliantly elucidated by Émile Durkheim in his work, The Evolution of Educational Thought in France, L'Evolution Pédagogique en France. I reference Durkheim here because he explains this emergence using the very terms of MI. This gives me the opportunity to introduce MI quickly. Indeed, Durkheim demonstrates how, at various points in the evolution of the education system, changes in macro-social conditions impact the educational aspirations and needs of social actors, and how these actors react, dare I say rationally, to these changes. This rationality is of course situated and mainly involves the actor's subjective understanding, as Wolf Ferhan will explain in a moment, along with Max Weber. Thus, Durkheim shows how the University of Paris was born of the combination of the action of all individuals and of none in particular. That is, as a non-intentional effect par excellence. As you know, MI is particularly interested in such effects as these offer enigmas to sociologists. Among these macro-social conditions, Durkheim cites the effervescence of the 11th century, the multiplication of students, their geographic mobility even before Erasmus, and their concentration in school groups attached to churches or monasteries. He also notes the establishment of the Capuchin monarchy in Paris at the beginning of the 12th century, which consecrated the École of Paris, dependent of Notre Dame, as the main institution for teaching. Durkheim further underscores the importance of the presence in Paris of a master of an immense renown, Abélard. The prestige of Paris in Europe and the influx of students led to the creation of schools in private homes, and as a consequence, it led to the relative emancipation of students and teachers from ecclesiastical control. This relative emancipation was institutionalized through the formation of teachers' guilds. The Latin term, universitas, did not originally denote a collective educational establishment, nor did it represent the universality of human teaching disciplines. Instead, it was borrowed from legal terminology and was synonymous with societas. The same was true for the word collegium. Therefore, Durkheim explains that the university did not begin as a center of study, but as a social group, the Teachers Guild. In this regard, it emerged as a unintentional effect of individual action. I think that the most interesting part of Durkheim's reasoning is not here, because he rejects the idea that such an institution could emerge totally unintentionally. Could the University of Paris, which had such a profound influence on subsequent times and across all of Europe, be only the result of fleeting local causes without any logical connection to the effect they produced? Durkheim's answer is no. There must be something else at play, a form of convergence of the individual aspirations capable of sustaining this emergence. But far from assuming a form of collective force that would compel individual actions, Durkheim posits that this connection operates between the individual's aspiration and their joint effect. He attributes the emergence of the university to something that comes under the rational dimension of actions, that is, meaning. In this case, it is the concept of education, the meaning that actors could ascribe to it, but surely without a clear conscience. Therefore, according to Durkheim, the emergence of the university was not, to some extent, was to some extent a united phenomenon of rational action, but also to another extent, it was the result of underlying rational intentions of the protagonist. Metaconscious, as Raymond Boudon would have put it. In this case, a moral aspiration ascribed to intellectual education that led to the need to join teachings. This metaconscious idea, as he explains, is a legacy of Christianity. According to this idea, the purpose of education is not to develop this or that particular skill, but to shape the mind as a whole. Therefore, it is no exaggeration to assert that Durkheim's analysis, which he delivered as a class taught at the Sorbonne at the dawn of the previous century, potentially even in this very location, focuses on the broad, abstract meaning that drives individual action and aligns with the individualistic method. Now, I wish to dedicate this conference in particular to Raymond Boudon, who worked so much to develop and promote the understanding of MI. Additionally, I dedicate this conference to those who have left us before they could witness the completion of this collective work. Joseph Agassi, who kept his vibrancy even at 96. Yann Jarvi, who regretted not being able to join us today due to illness. Robert Leroux, who left us abruptly. I also hold a special thought for my friend Sylvie Mesure, who authored a beautiful article on axiological rationality and Boudon's concept of dignity. For those who couldn't be present today, the lectures will be recorded and made available on the JMS website. I would also like to extend apologies on behalf of Francesco, who was unable to join us today, due in part to the recent birth of his son. Before I hand over to Wolf Fuhrmann, who will be speaking on a pivotal topic, Max Weber's understanding approach, I would like to draw your attention to his recent publication of a very interesting book on Max Weber's thought in social science methodology, Qu'est-ce que les sciences de la culture? Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Nathalie. Hello, everybody. My name is Michel Dubois. I'm the director of GEMAS, so I'm directing the lab, the sociology lab, once founded by Raymond Boudon 50 years ago. And it's my pleasure to be here today, and I will be chairing this first session on MI foundations. Thank you, Nathalie, for setting up this event, this beautiful event, in this beautiful place. I think we have four speakers this morning, and it means that we should try to... I will be the keeper of the time, so I'll be the one annoying you and stressing you just to be in time. I think we need to be finished around 12:30, if I'm correct, so we have a lot of time. Maybe we could have 20-25 minutes for each speaker and then keep 5 minutes for the discussion, 5 to 10 minutes, and I'll try to keep everything on track. So, happy to be here today, this morning with you. I see a lot of familiar figures on faces, so it's nice. Come, welcome, then.
In the methodology of the human sciences, to speak of understanding explanation could be seen as a confusion. Traditionally, in these disciplines, the distinction between explaining and understanding constitutes a methodological dividing line. To defend the possibility of an explanation of human actions is to accentuate the proximity between human sciences and natural sciences, while to maintain that they must be the object of understanding is, on the contrary, to mark the gap between the two poles. The thesis of the understanding specificity of the human sciences is defended by many researchers who wish, for example, to insist on the irreducibility of the mind to inert nature. In this case, they define understanding as an attitude that is either reflective or empathic, capable of grasping the nature of man. Conversely, those who defend the unity of scientific practices often deny that human phenomena are of a different order from the phenomena of nature. Beyond their disagreements, both share the conviction that the nature of the object analyzed determines the method to be used. Questions of philosophy of science thus seem to be inseparable from the traditional questions of moral philosophy, particularly those relating to the free or determined character of man. Max Weber, considered by the official historiography as one of the founding fathers of sociology, is in turn claimed by each of the protagonists of these polemics, who present him respectively as a guarantor capable of legitimizing the position adopted. In order to deepen our understanding of this question, I want to clarify Max Weber's position in the debate that took shape in his time. In order to do so, it seemed to me helpful to scrutinize one of his articles in which he explains his position. Russia and Kniess and the Logical Problems of Historical Political Economy, published between 1903 and 1906, and republished 1922. These articles present a true epistemological battlefield. In it, Weber tackled head-on the highly controversial question of the criterion for distinguishing between the sciences and questioned the idea that the nature of the object studied were the decisive criterion for classifying the sciences. In this way, he returns to the most commonly shared presupposition in the philosophy of science. Weber's thought progresses in the opposite direction to the dominant methodological reflections, which are wrongly based on his work. Our task is to elucidate these misreadings, which are essentially based on a misinterpretation, it's my position, of Weber's relationship with philosophical inquiry, and more particularly with the neo-Kantian school. This is reflected not only in the tendency to portray Weber as a defender of the philosophy of values, but also in the presentation of his work on the theory of science at the foundations of a sociological practice. The Gesamte Aufsätze zur Wissenschaftslehre, and even more so the first of his methodological articles on Roger and Kniess, are then read as founders of a philosophy of social science. While it is true that Max Weber was very close to Heinrich Rickert and some of his students, such as Emil Lask, the historiographical habits of simply marking him a member of the Neo-Kantian school in Baden must be reconsidered. We shall see how much more complex the situation turns out to be on examination, which will help us to better understand the specificity that Weber attributes to what he calls, at that time, the cultural sciences, Kulturwissenschaften. Weber usually refused the title of philosopher. According to him, philosophical questions are indeed irreconcilable with the scientific objective he has set himself, as he considers them to be worldviews, Weltanschauungen. An empirical science, as he says, must confine its ambition to the reasoned ordering of the empirical data. This is one of the leitmotifs of Weberian methodological texts. In this way, he acknowledged his debt to the Neo-Kantian distinction between being on one side and how to be on the other, between empirical science on one side and philosophy of values. With regard to questions of method, which Max Weber distinguishes from philosophical questions, an examination of how the Gesamte Aufsätze zur Wissenschaftslehre came into being leads to a reconsideration of the claim that Weber was a theoretician of science. Weber, indeed, never formulated such an ambition. His articles on scientific practice are above all situational writings and do not aim at a philosophical foundation of the science of culture. Most of them are reviews, and it is therefore necessary to trace the context in which the essays on Russia and Knies take place. In 1897, Weber succeeded one of his teachers, Karl Knies, who died the following year as professor of political economy at the University of Heidelberg. Although he had not taught since 1900 due to a nervous breakdown, Weber was asked by his colleagues in the philosophy faculty of the University of Heidelberg to contribute to a volume to celebrate the anniversary of the university reform of 1903. This text was thus primarily the result of a purchase and, according to Max Weber, a sighing article, Seufzer Aufsatz, as she said. Max Weber, unable to hand in his manuscript in time, published it in three parts between 1903 and 1906 in the journal edited by Gustav Schmoll, the famous political economist. In his critical studies in the Logic of the Cultural Sciences, 1906, a critical account of the methodological work of an historian, Eduard Meyer, Weber agrees with Meyer that the significance of methodological work for the practice of history should not be overestimated. He says, methodology can never be more than a safe reflection on the means that have proved useful in scientific practice, and one does not need to be made explicitly aware of those means in order to produce useful work, just as one does not need to have knowledge of anatomy in order to walk correctly. In no case should methodological reflections order the work of investigation. They do not constitute a prerequisite for research, but are a tool for intellectual vigilance, since they enable the historians to, I quote, avoid being oppressed by the sayings of dilettantes posing as philosophers. More importantly, they allow one to face a scientific crisis. These kinds of reflections are only legitimate insofar as they are called for by the discipline concerned in order to denounce and elucidate a misuse of concepts. Weber gnoseological articles do not aim at founding a nuisance, but at clarifying the use of logical concepts by economists and historians. My thesis is that these considerations are part of the so-called Lamprecht controversy. Between 1891 and 1908, the historian Karl Lamprecht published an ambitious history of Germany, Deutsche Geschichte, in 13 volumes, which you can see here, which develops the idea of the existence of psychological laws of history. It sparked a huge meteorological dispute within Germany's academic history establishment, especially Max Weber, who habitually referred to Lamprecht as a mere dilettante, one of his main insults. I cannot detail this point now, but I explain it very precisely in the book you generously mentioned before, Natalie. Political economy has been in an apparent crisis since the beginnings of the dispute over methods in 1883 between the leader of the historical school of economics at the time, Gustav Schmoller, and the marginalist Karl Menger. My point is that Weber reads this controversy through the prism of the more contemporary controversy around Lamprecht. Weber denounced attempts to turn political economy into an ethical science, as it says. In this, he does not only criticize Schmaller's work, but also an older tendency in economics already present in Russia and Mises to confuse science and philosophy of values. Weber focuses on the problem of irrationality, showing that it is found in many gnoseological works at the time. And Weber acknowledges that Mises may even appear to the reader as a mere pretext for what he has to say. The general question posed by Karl Mises in his Die politische Ökonomie von geschichtlichen Standpunkten, 1853 and 1883, second edition, is the possibility of a science of human actions. According to Mises, two facts are likely to hinder the latter, namely the historical and national relativity of human behavior on the one hand, and its fundamental irrationality on the other. The historical relativity was highlighted by the historical school of economics questioning of the what they called the cosmopolitanism defended by the classical economists. However, Mises does not give up on making political economy a science. He therefore defends a plurality of scientific regimes as a consequence of the ontological differences between their objects. The science of the mind are therefore opposed to the science of nature, as mind is opposed to nature, mind being the realm of freedom, nature that of necessity. The freedom of the mind is understood as irrational and therefore unpredictable. But Mises manages to preserve the idea of a regularity of economic behavior. According to him, the object of political economy is both irrational because it is free and necessary because the conditions of human actions are determined by a historical context and by the necessity of nature, both. This leads to the specificity of the historical science of which political economy is a part, and which constitute a third group of sciences between the sciences of the mind on one side, Geisteswissenschaft, and the sciences of nature on the other. For Mises, the human soul is not, however, unhistorical. It is part of the constant development that affects human life, both individual and collective. To account for this development, Mises defends an organicist conception of human societies. The economy has to identify the laws of development of peoples which vary according to what he calls national characteristics. The specificity, the peculiarity of the historical sciences is thus saved. The comparative work between economies of different times or of different nationalities cannot lead to identical laws, but only what he calls analogous laws of development. However, Weber considered that in doing so, he was inscribing them in a, what he calls, metaphysics, described, following Emil Lask as immanentists. That is an expression which he borrows to Emil Lask. And for which reality is not opposed to concepts, but comes from it, derives from it. In order to be grasped, the economic activities of a people has to be brought back to its essential personality. The complex gnoseological elaboration proposed by Mises would thus be determined by a metaphysical thesis concerning human freedom. Weber denounces the idea that the dignity of a science depends on the unknowable character of its object. He rejects the implicit value judgment that only unpredictable action can be considered and that only its understanding, defined as an empathic relationship, allows us to approach human free will. Finally, Weber underlines the fact that the different conceptions of the sciences of the mind are based on a double postulate. The first presupposes a difference in nature between human actions, and natural phenomena. The second, that only two exclusive methodological possibilities would be conceivable: nomological explanation on one side, or understanding on the other. By criticizing Kniess and many representatives of the historical sciences for determining the methodological characteristics of the sciences according to the nature of their objects, Weber contests the relevance of an ontological foundation of the sciences. This type of foundation had already been denounced by Wilhelm Widenbund and his pupil Heinrich Rickert, who had targeted Wilhelm Dilthey's Einleitung in die Geisteswissenschaften in his inaugural rectoral address in Strasbourg, entitled Geschichte und Naturwissenschaft, History and Natural Sciences, delivered in 1894. Windelband opposed a distinction between natural and spiritual sciences based on the ontological difference between nature and spirit. For Windelband, faithful to transcendental thought, phenomenal nature cannot be considered as external to the mind. On the contrary, he conceives it as a correlate of the mind's activity. Thus, it is according to the cognitive properties of the mind that we can distinguish the different sciences. Here you have the quotation. Heinrich Rickert refutes the opposition between physical world and psychic world, which he reads in detail, and which, according to him, cannot be a valid criterion of distinction between the sciences of nature and the sciences of culture. Weber inherits this analysis and even sees it as one of the aims of the article on Russia and Kniess, to test the fruitfulness of Rickert's thoughts for the historical sciences in general. He thus borrows the new formal way of characterizing regimes of scientificity. And in 1904, he specifies, I quote, "The fields of inquiry of scientific disciplines are based not on concrete relations between things, but on theoretical relations between problems." Like Rickert, Weber emphasizes that scientific knowledge involves the construction of concepts which elaborate and transform the empirical given to some specific question. In order to determine the specificity of a science, it is therefore necessary to start not from an ontological characterization of its field of investigation, but from what he calls its point of view, Standpunkt. Reality does not make sense in itself. It is a scientific interrogation that gives its meaning. Since each science is defined by the point of view from which it seeks to grasp reality, Weber rejects any quest for a fundamental science. Each science investigates specific phenomena, thus allowing the perspective of the other sciences to be completed, complexified, and nuanced, but none of them can found the others. Weber rejects, so, any ontological starting point that would consist in determining an elementary reality. He starts on the starting point that would consist in determining, on the contrary, from science as it is done, from its work of questioning and elaboration of concepts. Having rejected any ontological criterion, Weber had to look for a formal criterion that would allow him to distinguish between different types of science. However, he reproaches Kniess, in particular, for having confused cause and law and for having thus prevented any discovery for a formal criterion. Weber insists, on the contrary, on the difference between the principle of determinism, on the one hand, according to which all phenomena are linked to each other by invariable and necessary relations, and the principle of causality, on the other hand, for which, less strictly, all phenomena proceed at least from a cause. The term sciences of reality deserves an explanation here, Wirklichkeitswissenschaften. Reality is understood here as a logical category to be distinguished from necessity, which is derived from the nomological sciences. The interest in the real singularity cannot be satisfied by establishing universal laws. The criterion for an explanation is first and foremost the principle of causality and not determinism. Scientific explanation does not primarily involve the formulation of laws. Rather, in the explanation of concrete processes, I quote, the possibility of formulating judgments of causal necessity is by no means the rule, but rather the exception. The science of reality must above all bring to light singular causalities and not universal laws, as these do not account for the singular complexity of real phenomena. If Weber criticizes historical materialism, it is not because it wants to make history a science, nor because it has analyzed social and cultural phenomena from the point of view of their economic determination, but simply because some of its defenders have used it, I quote, as a universal method in the sense of a deduction of all cultural phenomena as being in the final analysis economically determined. He opens the way to a causal pluralism. Causality itself is, according to Weber, a category of our thinking which allows us to isolate certain phenomena as adequate causes within an infinite number of conditions with the help of the category of objective possibility. Weber thus emphasizes the exceptional character of empirical sciences capable of formulating laws. Most empirical sciences deal with complex singular phenomena. It is necessary to look first and foremost for the singular causes that explain such and such a rock fall or human behavior. And only a process of abstraction can lead to increased predictability, as in the case of laboratory experiments. Against those who emphasize the specificity of human behavior, Weber insists first on what is common to the explanation of singular complex inert or animate phenomena. Both are primarily based on the principle of causality. Sciences of reality does not correspond to a particular science, but it is one of two possible methodological orientations. When referring to the science he practices, Weber more frequently speaks of social sciences or cultural sciences, and frequently defines himself as a cultural historian. Weber borrowed the term science of culture from Rickert. Rickert speaks of natural sciences in that way. The term nature is used in a logical sense and in accordance with the terminology defined by Kant. The same applies to the term historical sciences. History refers to the individual and unique course of think. However, history, aiming to explain singular reality, must have a principle of selection. The mere distinction between nomothetic and ideographic sciences, though primary, is therefore not enough. As it says, we must combine material distinction with formal distinctions. And this combination is reflected in the name chosen by Ricoeur of cultural historical sciences. The characterization of culture as the space of values and meaning provides the distinctive material criterion of the sciences of culture and thus allows them to be differentiated from the sciences of nature, which seek to explain singular natural phenomena. Values and meaning have an ideal objectivity, but they do not exist in the same way as empirical reality. They are, what it says, Ricoeur, worth. These principles, taken up and deepened by Windelband and Ricoeur, explains why the latter systematically associates meaning and values. Ricoeur reappropriates equations by contrasting what exists on one side and what is worth on the other. And culture corresponds to what is beyond pure and simple facticity. It is part of an anhistorical and universal transcendental, and therefore cannot be confused with the term spirits, which Ricoeur rejects for its ambiguity. The historical researcher is not interested in what a particular reality has in common with other realities, but in what distinguishes it from them. That means the individual value it carries. The concept of culture plays the role of a principle of selection of the essential within reality, because it is thanks to it that the historian of culture scientist determines what has had a significant causal effect. Without this, what he calls, value relationship, Wertbeziehung, events remain devoid of any intelligible meaning. Not every causal relationship is retained by the historian. He is interested in what matters with regard to the guiding values of his work. However, the fact that Weber's thought was in contact with the philosophy of values that was developing in his time does not invalidate the fact that Weber cannot and should not be read as a philosophy of values himself. His aim is not to develop a hermeneutic of the meaning of action, but to explain the cause or causes of the actions he studies. Whereas for Ricoeur the validity of the guiding values of historical investigation is at least demanded of all members of a cultural community, Weber does not place scientific questioning in an anhistorical transcendentalism, but instead emphasizes its historical genesis. Understanding explanation reveals the motivations of actions that are endowed with meaning. However, Weber restricted his focus and did not include all motivated human behavior. Weber specifies that the limitation of the field of research to the economic and social structure of human collective life is voluntary. However, if understanding explanation is to be applied to economic and social phenomena, Weber emphasizes the complexity of the latter, which includes phenomena that are strictly economic, but also phenomena that the economy merely conditions, or phenomena with both economic and social significance. Weber also takes into account the complexity of motivations. And to this end, he proposes his famous typology of the determination of social action classified according to their intelligibility. That means according to the possibility of imputing meaning to them. The limits of understanding explanation are thus defined differently by Weber and by the historical economists he opposes. Weber challenges this boundary. We can only speak of an understanding explanation if we discover the motivations of an action. The boundary between understanding explanation and what we could speak of a simple explanation is thus independent of the boundary that separates human actions from natural phenomena. It separates motivated actions from behavior that the historians cannot link to an intention. For Weber, understanding explanation is therefore possible from the moment when we can impute a meaning to a phenomenon, even if it is, as in this case here, an inanimate tool. In conclusion, we could say that Weber rejects the alternative that, according to him, dominates discussion at his time. He is opposed both to a reduction of the specificity of the science of culture to the science of nature and to the idea of a total irreducibility between these two types of science. According to him, this false alternative is based on the amalgam between metaphysical thesis and scientific procedures. Weber points out that every scientific practice has its own cognitive purpose, and that the purpose of the reality sciences, the sciences of reality, is not fully satisfied by the formulation of universal laws, but requires the search for singular causes. In this sense, the historical sciences can go further than the other sciences of reality. Through the construction of ideal types of determinations of social action, they can reconstruct the motivations behind the events they study. Something that a meteorologist, for example, could not do. But Weber is careful not to replace the opposition between explanation and understanding with an opposition between causes and motivations, and always stresses that motivations are causes of a peculiar type. Thank you very much.